Are you aware of sort of the attention you're getting because you're a girl at this stage and you're so good?
I am aware. I don't really like all the attention because it just feels like everything's about me and they don't see the whole picture of my teammates. And without my teammates, I don't think we would be here right now. So
what do you think about being a 13-year-old girl and the idea that you're now a role model?
Never thought that I would be a role model at this age. So it was kind of shocking to me when I first came down to watch a game. There was like a crowd of people, so I was like kind of nervous, but then I was excited for it. So I just have to just be myself.
Monet Davis, the 13-year-old girl leading a team of boys in the Little League World Series. The series isn't over yet, but she's already won the cover of Sports Illustrated. We're going to talk with the Sklar brothers about her success later on in the show. First, though, American journalist James Foley was killed in Syria this week by a militant from the Islamic State. And we now know that before carrying out that execution, the group demanded $100 million in ransom money from the U.S. government. The U.S. did not pay it. It has a policy of not paying ransoms. But European countries do pay when they are asked, and their citizens usually get released by kidnappers. It's a dilemma that's growing more urgent now. The militant group that killed Foley is holding other Americans. Yohi Driessen is managing editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hi. Good to be with you.
Well, originally, the killer in the video of his execution, Foley's execution, said that it was in retaliation for U.S. airstrikes in Iraq. But now it seems that they had another motive. And so what do we know now about the ransom demands?
We know, frankly, that the amount of money they were asking for was so outlandish that it's hard to know whether it was a legitimate request for money mm-hmm. or whether this was just a way for them to ask for something so that if there is a backlash to the murder, they can later say, we made an offer, the U.S. didn't respond, the blame is on the U.S. We know that the amount of money they requested was roughly 100 million euro, which would make it about 132 million American dollars, which is exponentially more than had ever been paid by a European country, which does pay ransom money to get back one of its own.
Yeah. And so has that been a source of conflict between the U.S. and European countries when it comes to dealing with these terrorist groups?
It has. And I spent several years living in Iraq where colleagues of mine, European colleagues, have been kidnapped, freed, and then they left the country immediately. The presumption then had always been that they were freed because their governments paid ransom money. And that was a source of real tension because the feeling on the part of the U.S. government is that if you effectively reward kidnapping, you put all Westerners at risk, so not just Europeans, but also Americans. And so there's a feeling, anger might overstate it slightly, but of real opposition to the notion of directly funding a terror group to get back one of your own people, because that makes any Westerner, including Americans, at much greater risk.
And the New York Times recently published an investigation which found that European countries have paid roughly $125 million in ransom that's gone to terrorist groups associated with Al-Qaeda. So is that evidence then that this seems to be causing these kinds of kidnappings, that this is an incentive, all this ransom money?
It's something where certainly for most of the groups that are Al-Qaeda affiliates around the world, this is a primary source of how they fund their operations, particularly in Somalia, where you have pirates not always affiliated with Al-Qaeda. Sometimes it's purely basically that they're impoverished and need money. But they know that if they take a Westerner and that Westerner lives, they can get that person back for some amount of money. Usually it's negotiated down. It's never in the realm of $100 million. But we should also remember that part of what is talked about in the Times article is money. Part of what we should think about when we're talking, negotiating with terrorists are people. Because often what they ask for isn't simply money. It may be money plus the release of prisoners. It may simply be the release of prisoners. And that makes it even more complicated. Because then if you are giving them ransom money plus other terrorists back in return, you make the kidnapping even more appealing than it would be if it was just for money.
Well, in fact, the United States did that very recently with Bo Bergdahl. The U.S. traded Guantanamo prisoners for his release.
Exactly. And I think that's a very fair question, because the Bo Bergdahl trade was made with members of the Haqqani Network, which is an ally of the Taliban that is formally designated by our State Department as a terrorist organization. So the response by the Obama White House would probably be, this was a prisoner swap. This wasn't paying a ransom. These negotiations were conducted through intermediaries, not directly with the Haqqanis. But that strikes me as really trying to walk a very narrow line. fundamentally, we did negotiate with the terror group and we did give them what they wanted to get back one of our own. So the idea that we never negotiate and should never negotiate is more rhetorical than it is actually what's been our practice over the last 5 years.
Well, in fact, perhaps even longer than that, when you consider Iran and the hostage taking there in the 70s, Lebanon in the 80s, the U.S. probably engaged in a lot of backroom negotiations in those two cases.
Exactly. And if we want to go back even further or look at a different part of the world, we have the numerous Americans who've been taken hostage in Latin American countries, in Colombia, Mexico, elsewhere. Many of them have been freed in part because of money paid by their families or their companies. But there's been a presumption for a very long time that some of them were freed because of money from the CIA or elsewhere from the U.S. government. There is no question that we've talked to terror groups before. There's no question that something in the past has been given to them. That's been the case for a long time. It's also been the case in parts of the world that go way beyond the Middle East.
So given the fact that there is at least one other, possibly more, Americans being held by this group, the Islamic State, one we know, Stephen Sotloff, who I think has written for your organization, Foreign Policy, now that there has been a very public and horrifying execution, do you think the United States reevaluate its policy of negotiating, of paying money to release the prisoners?
It's a good question, but no, I don't. Steve Sotloff, he has written for us in the past. He's written for Time magazine, obviously, like Jim Foley, a very, very brave person. I think everyone listening would hope that, on a human level, everyone would hope that he comes back safely. But no, I don't. And it's an interesting question to think about the motivations of the Islamic State in releasing this video. Part of it might simply have been to try to get more followers to show this is what we're willing to do to Americans, this is what we're brave enough to do to an American. Part of it might have been a sincere belief that this might make the White House reevaluate their bombing campaign. My gut tells me it'll have the exact opposite effect. My gut is that Americans watching this will be so horrified and so sickened and so infuriated that if anything, they'll say, intensify the bombing campaign. They'll say, these are jihadists that we can't possibly negotiate with. These are madmen. These are brutal fanatics. Do whatever you need to defeat them. So if the goal of the Islamic State was to persuade the U.S. to end the airstrikes, to reduce the airstrikes, my gut is it will have the exact opposite effect.
Yohi Drizin, Managing Editor at Foreign Policy, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, what do you think? Should the U.S. pay ransom for citizens captured by militants abroad? You can give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, you can get almost anything delivered these days, but how do these apps make any money? And why is Uber getting into the delivery business? That story is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You can now make dinner reservations and plan to drink too much wine with that coq au vin in one fell app swoop. Or maybe book a flight to Madagascar and book a ride home at the same time. The rideshare company Uber just partnered with companies like OpenTable and United. These new partners can embed the Uber app right into their own websites and mobile apps. And this is just the latest power play by the rideshare juggernaut, the same company that hired one of President Obama's closest advisors earlier this week. Joining us now to make sense of this move is Mark Million. He's the global tech writer and editor for Bloomberg. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so Uber is pairing with OpenTable, United, Starbucks even. What's in it for Uber and for these other companies?
For Uber, the goal is to get as many people thinking about their service and booking rides on their platform. They're facing competition globally and strong ones that are regionally based. Uber is the biggest right now around the world, and they want to solidify that by partnering up with other app developers and airlines and Hyatt hotels and just about everyone you can think of, so that when you check into your hotel room or check into your flight or open your calendar, you'll get a button there to book an Uber ride and see, you know, how far away the nearest driver is and hop right in his vehicle.
And are their competitors Lyft or Sidecar, are they doing the same thing or trying to do the same thing?
They aren't doing the same thing yet, but I think it's a pretty reasonable guess that they will be doing something like this fairly soon. Sort of taxi booking, ride sharing space among these technology companies is very much a sort of tit for tat game, where Uber just a couple weeks ago launched a this carpooling service where you can get from here to there for a bit cheaper if you agree to ride with a stranger. They're piloting it in San Francisco. The next day, Lyft launched an identical service. Mm. So these guys are all trying to one up each other in every aspect of their business.
And then they're also trying to get into delivering things as well as delivering people.
Yeah, that's right. Uber is doing a whole ton of these different initiatives. They're piloting different programs. The one that you're referring to is called Corner Store, which they're doing in Washington, D.C. now, where, if you're a D.C. resident, you can pull up your Uber app and request an Uber driver deliver you whatever you might need from a pharmacy. It's, everything from toothpaste to diapers and 100 other items that a driver will pick up and deliver right to your door. They've done sort of like these funny little initiatives as almost like marketing stunts. They'll do ice cream in the summers in some cities. In New York, they delivered kittens so you could play with kittens. But some of these...
That sounds like a PR stunt to me, a little bit.
Total PR stunt. And they've also let you like ride around in a DeLorean car. Some of these actually hint at potential new businesses. In New York, they're doing courier service, where if you're a business and you want to quickly deliver a package by bicycle messenger across the city, you can do that through Uber. And in Nashville and Atlanta, they're piloting a program where you can call up Uber to get a mover to pick up your couch or something and move it to a new location.
Well, meanwhile, they're fighting some pretty big battles in state legislatures across the country, including here in California. And is that why they hire David Plouffe, President Obama's advisor?
Yeah, I mean, Plouffe was really Obama's right-hand man in both of the elections and has continued to be an advisor over the years. Plouffe is, well-versed in running national campaigns. Clearly, Obama's campaigns really have been global events. And so Uber sees him as someone with the expertise to, as they say, lead the Uber campaign. They're facing off, as you mentioned, with regulators and city officials all around the world. Just in Germany, three of the biggest cities in Germany are trying to shut Uber down, and Uber has continued to operate. And meanwhile, they need to kind of massage their image so they're not seen as sort of this big technology bully as they've grown and become an international sensation.
So the big issue, at least here in California, and I don't know if it's the same issue in places like Germany and elsewhere, is liability insurance and whether or not the drivers should have more insurance than their own personal insurance.
That's right. And here in California, as you alluded to, there's an assemblywoman who is trying to pass a rule that would require Uber and companies like it, including Lyft and Sidecar, to have a minimum amount of insurance and a number of other things like more extensive background checks and drug testing. And not surprisingly, the Uber and the other ride sharing companies are battling the legislature on this. They say that they already go above and beyond the requirements of the law. In some cases, the law required, or the rule would require $750,000 in commercial liability, where Uber and some of the other companies already offer $1 million. But the sticking points are, you know, nuances of the rule that would require, you know, the companies to provide commercial insurance even when the cars are not, you know, actively driving a passenger around. There was, of course, this famous case where a driver on New Year's Eve unfortunately hit a young girl. Mm-hmm. And Uber denied responsibility because he didn't technically have a passenger in the back seat at the time. And so this rule is designed to, you know, alleviate some of those loopholes.
So it seems that they're taking these fights very seriously, and at least on the PR front. Are they spending tons of money lobbying and trying to make sure that this law does not go into effect?
Oh, yeah. Well, for one, I can guarantee that David Plouffe's hire was not a cheap one for the company. But they have they've ramped up their lobbying. They have policy and PR professionals all over the world, including in Washington, including several in California. And they're sending, you know, policy folks to some of these lobbying events and efforts and to fight, you know, regulation like this, as are the other ride-sharing companies who have said, you know, the CEO of Sidecar said that if this passes, it's a disaster and it would literally spell the end of the industry. I'm not sure that it's that serious, but anything that will cost these companies more money, they want to fight against.
Mark Million covers global tech for Bloomberg. Thank you.
Thanks.
So as we just talked about, Uber is looking into getting into online delivery. It's offering a motley list of items in the D.C. area for now. Well, it's not just Uber. If you go to the App Store, you'll find scores of startups offering to deliver whatever you want, whenever you want it. Well, is this a bold new world in e-commerce or just another tech trend that's bound to implode? Joining us now is John Dayton. He's a professor at the Harvard Business School. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, these online delivery services have been attempted before, and you actually teach a course in this, and you study Webvan, the online grocery delivery service that went bankrupt in 2001. What happened with Webvan?
Webvan was part of an ambitious project to digitize the supply chain that runs from thousands and thousands of factories around the world to millions and millions of homes. I mean, it's an enormous project. It's probably one of the great IT projects of the digital era, and people have been chasing that goal ever since the internet began to emerge. There have been some great successes. I mean, I think Amazon saw this opportunity a long time ago and has approached it in a very systematic and quite successful way. Webvan, in a sense, was the opposite of Amazon. Where Amazon started small, picked up perfect category books, picked the order placement side of the business and left delivery to FedEx and UPS, Webvan tried to do the whole thing. It tried, and in particular, it tried to solve the delivery problem. And it turns out, and I think the big learning from the contrast between those two companies is the delivery end is the grunt work end of the supply chain. It's where you incur cost and you don't make any money. So I watch the current plethora of little delivery businesses and some big ones like Uber, and I think that's not the place to start.
So you don't make any money on the delivery part of it? That's just not feasible?
Well, the reason that a number of people have suddenly decided that you can make money is because there are small economies to be had today to connect a network of vehicles, with the idea of part-time workers who can use their vehicles when there's demand. I mean, these are factors. They will reduce the economics over the conventional economics of home delivery as they were at the time of Webvan, but not by much.
Well, right, because the companies aren't paying for a fleet of vans. They're not paying for any of the costs associated with driving the vans. They're just linking up an independent contractor who has his or her own car with the customer.
That's the idea, that they're mobilizing idle resources.
So that can't make money?
Well, it's not going to make enough money. I mean, it'll keep some people in business, but then Shining Shoes keeps quite a few people in business. It's difficult to understand how that, by trying to digitize the supply chain from the delivery end, how that is going to produce this large economic opportunity, this revolution in the organization of American business. It's just starting at the wrong end. That's my view. Now, there's good VC money that's being thrown at the opportunity, and that money is smart and knows what it's doing. But I think they're hoping that something will emerge, some pivot will occur that'll turn this into something more than simply a network of idle taxi drivers.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, some of the cases are a little eyebrow-raising. I was talking to a friend the other day who said her daughter ordered a cup of tea from one of these services, and they delivered it. A cup of tea.
That's the kind of problem you face. The first people to buy Webvan were people who lived at the wrong end of a long flight of stairs. The people who capitalize on these systems are those that are the most costly to serve. I'm looking for scale as we try to digitize the retail economy, and I don't see scale in delivery. I see lower costs than once before, but I don't see the kind of network effects that are certainly there to be had at the store end of the business and at the manufacturer end of the business.
So is this a case where only the big guys can succeed, something like an Amazon?
As I said, they outsourced the retailing of the delivery of books. They delayed investing in delivery until really in the last year or so, and even then rather tentatively. And so as they've moved into food, you'll notice that they're delivering in Seattle, I believe in L.A., in some West Coast markets, but by no means trying to roll out on a larger scale because they understand that that's not where the money is made.
Yeah. Well, what if you're in a place like San Francisco or Manhattan where delivery happens a lot on two wheels, on bicycles? Is that...
Yes, and where, in addition, people live at very high density, if you take New York.
Right.
So the success of Fresh Direct is important in the big picture, but it's not going to be replicated outside of very highly concentrated cities. And yes, bicycles, delivery on foot. You know, once you're mobilizing idle resources, it's amazing what you can get. It just doesn't seem to me to be the really big opportunity that venture capitalists are looking for when they put real money behind these projects.
John Dayton, professor at the Harvard Business School, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Here's a question for you, press players. If you could get any product or service delivered to your front door, what would it be? Maybe an LCD sound system song? Oh, you have that right now. Best answers, G-rated. Get a shout out in our feedback segment at the end of the show. You can tweet us at KCRW Press Play or go to our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the strange story of Frank, the movie starring Michael Fassbender, is based on the real-life experience of John Ronson when he joined an art band in England. His story after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. Frank is a new movie about an avant-garde pop musician who wears a big fake head and nobody knows who he really is.
How to describe Frank? One, two, three, four.
Well, there's the head, of course.
He never takes it off.
You think it's weird?
Would it help if I said my facial expressions out loud? Welcoming smile.
Delighted look.
But what goes on inside the head inside that head?
I find this inspiring.
Is music.
People should know about you. You should be famous.
Flattered grin, followed by a bashful half-smile.
Stop saying your facial expressions out loud. It's extremely annoying.
The movie starring Michael Fassbender and Maggie Gyllenhaal was inspired by a real avant-garde pop musician in Britain in the 1980s who wore a big fake head. His name was Chris Seavey, and his character with the head was called Frank Sidebottom. British writer John Ronson played keyboards with the Frank Sidebottom Oh Blimey Big Band, and he co-wrote the script for the movie Frank, based loosely on his experiences. And you may also know John Ronson from his book, The Psychopath Test, or from his many This American Life stories. Welcome, John.
Hey, Madeline, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So in the movie at the beginning, this young wannabe musician with the name John, coincidentally, is picked up by a group of strange musicians, including Frank, the leader of the band, the guy with the big head. And John ends up playing keyboards in his band. And is that what happened to you? You were just picked up by this weird band?
Yeah, I was in an office in central London, an entertainment's office, and the phone rang. And this frantic voice on the other end of the phone said, Frank's supposed to be playing in London tonight, but our keyboard player can't make it. And so we're going to have to cancel unless you know any keyboard players. And I kind of swallowed and said, I play keyboards. And he said, well, you're in. And I said, but I don't know any of your songs. And he said, can you play C, F and G? And it was kind of fortunate that my limitations matched exactly their limitations. And that's how I ended up joining the band. And I feel like Alice going down the rabbit hole.
So did you also spend a long time with them, like the character does in the movie, and go away to cut an album with them?
I didn't do that, but I did stay on. I went on the road with them for about 3 years. I dropped everything and moved to Manchester. They asked me, after the first show, they asked me if I wanted to be in the band full time. And I immediately quit college and moved to Manchester and spent the next 3 years crisscrossing the north of England in a little van, playing to, 300-400 people a night. And it was extraordinary. That nothing makes a 19-year-old boy feel more alive than sitting in a van at 2 o'clock in the morning next to a man wearing a big fake head.
Now seems a perfect opportunity to describe that head.
Okay, so the real Frank's head had these two huge bug eyes staring, and the lips were slightly parted, as if to express mild surprise, and very smooth hair, very comic, looked like, kind of Betty Boop or something
like
that.
Yeah, a bit black plastered hair, and the head is really big. It's like, is it paper mache?
Yeah, and very round. I think he was inspired by ping pong balls. That's what he told me one day. He was looking at ping pong ball, and it was like a kind of eureka moment for him. And it's interesting, actually, in the movie, it's really strange how you sort of imbue your own ideas of what's going on inside the head, looking at this facial expression that never changes. The expression seems to change in the movie. Mm. And I think it's really smart, tiny little changes that they made to the head that give you that kind of optical illusion.
Now, in the movie, Frank never takes the head off. Did Chris Seavey take the head off in real life?
He did, although quite often he would keep it on like way beyond the call of duty. So we'd play a show that would end at maybe 11 o'clock at night, and 2 o'clock in the morning, he's still wearing the head. I found that just, mysterious and wonderful. My favourite times were when he would keep the head on. And he wouldn't answer to Chris when he had the head on. If you said, that was a good show, Chris, you'd just be met with this kind of silence and his two eyes staring blankly at you. And then if you said, it was a good show, Frank, he'd go, oh, yes, it was. So
he had a different voice when he was Frank?
Yeah, he had the real Frank had this kind of high-pitched nasal voice. It was not sound like that. And he would wear a swimmer's nose peg underneath the head to keep the voice nasal. And I'd notice that when he would, you know, eventually take the head off and take the nose clip off, the nose clip would have dug into his nose for hours. And so removing it, you know, he would sort of flinch in pain. And he'd look away, actually, from you, almost like it was a sort of act of modesty. He'd remove the nose clip without anybody looking at him. But I would sometimes spot him flinch in pain. So it would hurt, to be frank.
Did he want to shift into a totally different personality? Is that part of it? Or was it all just a performance and a fun time?
I think it was, there was more to it than that. I've noticed this myself. Like, I remember I was at a Halloween party 2 years ago and I wore a fake head and I kept it on all night. It felt really safe in there. All my social anxiety just melted away. It was like a safe space inside this ghoul head. And, I think being Frank was like safe and comfortable for Chris. In real life, Chris was quite chaotic. I mean, nowhere near as chaotic as the movie Frank, who was inspired by people like Daniel Johnson, you know, who live a life of you know, extreme chaos. Chris wasn't like that, but he was hedonistic and he was a little out of control, whereas Frank was like a child. And I think it's no coincidence that Chris would create this innocent, safe persona.
And in the movie, Frank, he actually, it seems sad. He's described as having a mental illness and he has a breakdown.
Yeah. In the movie. Well, I suppose we had to work out, you know, we gave ourselves the rule that our Frank would never take the head off. So then we had to try and work out, well, why would that be? Well, both the practicalities of it, which includes like, you know, toothbrushes with very long handles, and also the psychology behind it. And we became really interested in stories of other great outsider artists. And the one that I found most compelling, and I'm a huge fan of anyway, is the story of Daniel Johnson, whose enormous talent clashed with a severe bipolar disorder.
True love will find you in the end. You'll find out just who was your friend.
And his songs are both maybe enriched but also damaged by this manic depression. And I was really interested in the idea that from the outside, it seems kind of wonderful. You know, everybody has these ideas of the great mentally ill artist, and we idealize those people. But in reality, if you are that person or you live with that person, there's nothing fabulous about it at all. And so we became really interested in exploring those ideas in the film.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with John Ronson. He wrote the new movie, Frank. And we're talking about mental illness. And a lot of your work, you're interested in mental illness. I mean, your famous book, The Psychopath Test, obviously delves into that from a more humorous aspect, point of view, I guess. What is your attraction to exploring people's extreme mental illnesses?
I think, well, I've had personal experience of it, you know, with loved ones and so on. And I'm also interested in our views towards them. So in the movie, we play with the myth of it versus the reality of it.
Well, it's interesting when you think about that in relation to Frank and his wearing of the head, because at least in the movie, I'm speaking about that Frank, that at the same time, as it might be a refuge for him and he might be able to hide his mental illness inside the head, he's also really making it obvious because you can't avoid that head.
Yes, absolutely. That's funny, actually, to say that. It's almost like kind of obsessive compulsive disorder, that the thing that you are, you know, the classic thing about OCD is, you know, you're worried that the lights, you've left the power on, and so you turn the light on and off, on and off, on and off until the light breaks. You're worried about being misunderstood, so you repeat the same phrase 100 times until it loses all its meaning. Mm. What I love is John, the character based on me, joins this band and thinks, God, Frank's so talented. It must be because he's mentally ill. And if only I was a bit more mentally ill, if only I had a more abusive childhood, I could be talented too. When fact is, Frank's mental illness, all it does is slow him down.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, he thinks, if only I could bring them to the world will see the genius, and then everything will come up roses. And it's that clash between the real world and Frank's world that is their undoing, actually, that the band just can't function in real life commercial celebrity.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. You know, we live in a success-obsessed world, and I really wanted to write a film that sort of celebrated failure. You know, I went on a TV chat show when I first moved to New York, and I was a bit depressed. You know, I'd just moved from London to New York, and I was sort of second guessing myself. Did I make a mistake? And you know, and I felt a bit depressed. And in the midst of this, I went on a TV chat show, and I was kind of talking about how I was wrong, but because I was sort of feeling depressed and miserable, I was talking about how in Britain people are better off with failure. You know, they handle failure better in Britain than they do in America, which I think isn't true, but I was sort of feeling that way at the time. Anyway, the TV host said, no, in America, you know, we love failure because the little boy, you know, they throw the baseball and he misses the baseball, but then they throw the baseball again and he misses it, and then they throw the baseball again and he hits it out of the park. And everybody in the audience cheered. Mm. But that meant that failure is okay if it's a stop off on the road to success. And what I wanted to write with Frank was a film about how, you know, failure is just fine, you know, and being marginal is fine, and having no audience is fine, and we should stop stressing. And some people should be playing to 15 people in a room. Some people should be marginal, and that's okay.
And you've written that you knew the exact moment when failure began for Chris, CV, and Frank.
Mm. Everyone around us was becoming famous, and we were just crisscrossing the north of England in our transit van. And obviously we were getting kind of eaten up with everybody else's success. And so we decided to be more mainstream. And the moment failure began for Chris was when he decided that we should rehearse. And, you know, the alarm bells were ringing. And sure enough, we failed.
John Ronson, co-writer of the new movie Frank, which is in theaters this week. John, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline. Lovely talking to you again.
El Madrid, it's nice to see you. It's really nice to be here. I love you all.
Michael Fassbender singing I Love You All in the movie Frank. Fassbender is featured on this week's Guest DJ Project, where we learned he is a total metalhead. Take a listen. We have a link at our website, kcrw.org/pressplay. All right, Warren Olney.
It is I.
I'm waiting for your sequel here.
We will be talking today about the Ban the Box movement, which has now become law in 12 states and 60 cities, and it has to do with getting rid of the box on the application form that says, have you ever been arrested? Because it turns out that almost a third of Americans now have been arrested since the 1990s,
really?
Given the big tough-on-crime era. And many of the arrests have not produced even charges, let alone convictions, and yet they still stay there as arrests. And employers and landlords and banks and others apparently just find that out and reject immediately those people for whatever it is they want.
All right. That sounds like a fascinating discussion coming up at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, two heads are better than one. The Sklar brothers are here to talk sports. That's next on Press Play.
Thank you.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time to talk sports.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Yes, the Sklar brothers are here, Randy and Jason, and they're going to update us on what's happening in the wide world of sports.
It is wild. It's wild and wide, and it's kind of an amazing time right now.
I know. Well, let's talk about Monet Davis, the 13-year-old girl from South Philly. She's got a 70-mile-per-hour pitch.
Fastball. Which, by the way, 70 miles per hour from the distance at which Little Leaguers are pitching has been sort of pushed out to, if it was a Major League Baseball, 91 miles per hour. So she is throwing some, as she says, throwing some gas, which is the term. Like they're pumping some cheese, throwing
pumping some
heat. Gas, as it were.
And so, no, that would be a 91-mile-an-hour fastball if it was at the full 60 feet.
It's so funny. And I saw this video that about throw like a girl. It's like they asked.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see that? It was an ad, but it was just fantastic about throw like a girl. And they asked adults and teenagers, what's it like to throw like a girl? And everyone's like, eh.
Right, you know,
like limp wrist throw, like uncoordinated and terrible. And then they ask kids who were 9 and 10 years old, like, or 9 years old, throw like, how do you throw like a girl? And they're like, you mean throw like me? And so now you see this girl, she's 13, Monet Davis, throwing and just whiffing guys.
And didn't she even say that? She's like, this is how you throw like a girl?
Yeah. Kind of in that same way. Yeah. I think it's so beautiful that came out, that she sort of has emerged on this national stage.
And it's taken the nation by storm.
34,000, I think, fans came out to watch that Little League game last night. The Seattle Mariners played the Philadelphia Phillies last night, 25,000 fans. So more showed up to watch this. There were over 350 press credentials at this game. That's how big of a story it is.
And it's not a sideshow like, well, we just have a girl on our team. Like, she's the reason why Pennsylvania is moving so far in this tournament, has a shot perhaps to even make it to the finals.
They lost. Okay.
Right. To a very tough Nevada team.
Everybody's saying that this Nevada team is some of the best hitters that we've seen in a long time.
And she still struck guys out. She still made people look silly. She still looked decent.
She had to come out of the game because they do pitch counts for these kids. They don't want them to overthrow and hurt their arms.
Yeah.
So she could only pitch 60 pitches if she wanted to pitch then again on Saturday. So, which is like the big championship game to see who plays the world team, the team to emerge from like the, you know, South Korea, mm-hmm. Japan and whatnot. And so they limited her. And once she came out, kind of the floodgates opened.
Well, why? I guess the question is raised now. Why so few girls then?
You know, I don't know. And right now,
maybe it'll change. Maybe this will change it. You kind of think of.
She's on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
And rightly so. I mean, no one's saying why. Everybody's saying, of course, that she belongs on the cover. This is bigger than baseball.
It's exciting. She's 13 years old. You know, there's a real good chance she could, you know, move on into her high school and try out for a high school team and play high school ball. You don't know. I mean, at this point, she certainly
has the talent. And as people develop, you don't know. I mean, it's like she could
never play professional baseball.
I mean, would never say never. I would say it's probably difficult. And you know, granted, there was a great team, and there was a great ESPN 30 for 30 about the team that we remember the most, that was Kirkland, Washington team that played in like 1982, and it was around the time that we were playing Little League, and they're in 81, and they finally beat the Taiwan team that had just crushed us for so long, and they had a pitcher who was fantastic. I mean, probably the best Little League pitcher that has ever pitched for like the American, and this kid was amazing, and he was a marginal pitcher in college, you know what I mean? He kind of, as players develop.
Yeah.
This is not a good indication of what sort of a professional player you would be. Now, there are a lot of professional players who did play Little League and played in the Little League World Series. But I don't know. Well, time will tell.
Well, they don't allow girls to play in professional baseball, right? Women.
Well, I don't think they do. They don't, right? But if someone has the talent, I certainly could see a minor league team signing up a woman to play. I certainly could see that happening.
Has that ever happened?
I don't think it's happened yet.
Not sure. I wish I had that information. But, I mean, look, there are some women who play hockey. There's Manon Raimet, the goalie who played professional hockey. I mean, and that's a contact sport.
And then she wants to go into basketball anyway. So she says baseball's not even her favorite sport.
Which is so funny. It just shows what a talented athlete she is.
Okay, moving on to pro baseball here. The Angels doing really well until last night.
The Angels, by the way, won last night, but they had a much bigger loss.
Yeah.
And they lost their pitcher, their ace of the staff, Garrett Richards, on a very freak play. And by the way, this can happen. This is how precious and how much a season can turn in one moment. So the Angels, who are this team that, like the Dodgers, has spent a lot of money on their players, players like Josh Hamilton, players like Albert Pujols. You have guys that they've sort of developed, like Mike Trout, who is the best player in, I would say, in both leagues right now. Okay, he's on par to be the MVP of the American League, in my opinion. So the Angels have a lot of great players and a lot of promise, but they haven't put it together. They have not won a World Series, and I think their fan base is getting a little antsy. Now they play in a division with Oakland, which is a team that typically doesn't spend a lot of money. They just went out and spent a lot of money on two pitchers to bolster their rotation. They were far and away the best team, and the Angels ran them down. Recently, the Angels just took over the
first place
in the American League Western Division. However, Garrett Richards, who is their star pitcher, who 13-4 this year, opponents are hitting 195 against him.
Under 200, under the Mendoza line.
Under the famed Mendoza line. If you're hitting under that, you're not playing well. If you're hitting under that as a player, you get sent down to the minors. That's what other teams are hitting against him. He's the guy who, when he goes out there, the Angels say, we're going to win this game. So for him to get hurt, and it was he was just running over to first to cover first base on a ball that was hit towards second base to the first baseman, and his knee buckled. I don't know if he caught on something. I don't know if he just tripped on but his knee buckled, and it's like a patella injury. This could be it for the year. I hope he comes back even strong next year. But, you know, pitchers use their legs so much to push off, to plant.
Yeah.
And
it would be the equivalent if the Dodgers lost Clayton Kershaw right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's how detrimental it would be to
the Dodgers have other great pitchers, but that's not the ace. That's the guy who, when you start the playoff series, he pitches the first game for you. Maybe he pitches. That's the, excuse me if I can make this reference, he's the Monet Davis of the pitching staff. I mean, he is.
But does he pitch as fast as she does?
He does. He actually throws up near 100 even in the seventh inning, which is amazing.
So hoping for an I-5 series.
Oh, that would be amazing. That would be incredible. And actually, I think the
long shot.
It's not a long shot yet, but I think
this was a
big blow to
a blow.
Let's talk about basketball, and I'm not really sure what to say about this. I just want to play the clip of Steve Ballmer, new owner of the LA Clippers, went a little crazy.
Turn your volume down.
Okay, here it goes.
It was like he was introducing Windows 2014.
By the way, thank God he finally now has a venue where he can act that way.
And it seems almost appropriate.
By the way, it was almost too much for that.
Well, I think what was really funny was watching the cutaways of the players.
Players, and they were cracking up.
Looking at each other. Like, ooh, what?
Yeah, that's way too excited for a guy in a button-down shirt and a hat to be acting right now. But, I mean, look, it's good news for them.
They need some good news.
That aside, his antics aside, he's kind of like your crazy uncle who won't stop dancing at a bar mitzvah. It's like everybody's, get him out of here.
Look, he's really in the moment.
I'm really excited for him.
But
I know. Well, it did go on.
Let
and
him
on.
Dance it
did.
Off. Maybe he'll get tired. But
yeah, it went on for a while. So he said this too, and I want to play this and get your reaction.
Yes, I do live in Seattle. No, we can all love Seattle. There's no team there. We're not moving the Clippers to Seattle.
So really?
That's actually, that was the first thing that Clippers fans were fearful of, that they are going to move the team. You've got two teams here, the Lakers and the Clippers. So why not move a team up to Seattle? They used to have the Supersonics, who then moved to Oklahoma City, and now they're super successful because they got Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook. But the point is that he did mention that out loud, and, you know, if he's a man of his word, he said it out in front of lots of people. So now hopefully Clippers fans can breathe a sigh of relief. They're not going to go anywhere. The Clippers are the marquee basketball team in Los Angeles now. Make no mistake. And now that you've got the owner controversy somewhat has subsided, there's a real chance for the Clippers to make it out of the West, which is very tough. I still think they're the third best team in the West right now.
You got to honor the Spurs. Even though they're getting older, the Spurs are like the Expendables. We've said this before. A lot of old guys, some foreign guy, people from other countries, no Steven Seagal, thankfully.
Yeah.
That's who the Spurs are, and they keep doing
it
every year.
They get the job done. So the Spurs are great, and I would say Oklahoma City, again, is another. That's who knocked the Clippers out of the playoffs last year. But without any owner, coach, player strife going on, I feel like
you got a Hall of Fame coach.
You have a Hall of Fame coach in Doc Rivers.
You got a star in Chris Paul. You've got an emerging star in Blake Griffin. You've got some other pieces around them.
The key is if they can remain healthy, because last year J.J. Redick, who is a great shooter, not a great defender, wasn't that healthy. So he missed a lot of games. And with him on the floor, the team is instantly more dangerous because he spreads out and suddenly there's more room for Blake Griffin to move around. There's more room for Chris Paul to move around. If you don't have him on the floor, if he's hurt, that's a big problem. So they got to keep everybody healthy. And we'll see what kind of a run they can make. Now, he bought the team, Ballmer, for $2 billion.
Overpriced a little bit.
But everything in L.A. is overpriced. I mean, think about how much the Dodgers were sold for. But $2 billion, which everybody is like, I'm glad that Ballmer is the owner. But as fans, you shouldn't be that glad because some of that is going to get passed on to you. Ticket prices are going to go up.
You're ready for a $28 pretzel.
Yeah.
Yipes.
I mean, it will come back to
you. He's a businessman. He doesn't like to lose money. So I think it's going to be passed on to the fans and somewhat. But the good news is this is a good team. This is the Clippers of now. This isn't the Clippers of the late 90s. They're good. And so some of it can be masked in, yeah, it's going to cost more because the Clippers are in it.
Randy and Jason Sklar, and download their stand-up special. It's called What Are We Talking About on iTunes or Netflix. Also, their podcast, Scarborough Country, is available for free as
on iTunes and earwolf.com.
Excellent. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Madeline.
Jolie Myers is in the house.
Decked out in a giant papier-mâché head.
That's right.
Like you do.
It looks strangely like your head.
Just bigger. In honor of Uber's new delivery service in D.C., a list of things that should be delivered that are not delivered yet. Paul Arolio on Facebook says, world peace should be delivered door to door. Paul, So sweet of you. Horacio Oliveira on Twitter says he'd like a new job. One that he likes, delivered to his doorstep. Garrett tweets that he wants a can of tennis balls. Okay. David Ross wants printer ink on demand. It always runs out at the worst times.
That is so true.
Hashtag ink refill conspiracy. Like that. That was his thought on that. James Duenas wishes there was a hug delivery service. Agreed. And Katarina says simply...
As long as it's not too long.
Short hug. Not the lingering.
Yeah, no.
Katarina says puppies. Also agree. And I want Uber to deliver me a DiGiorno pizza so I can tweet that it's both delivery and DiGiorno. In your face, freezer pizza. That's all I got today.
Okay, Jolie Myers. I'm waiting for lunch to be delivered because I'm starving. And it is time for Warren Olney and To the Point, so stay tuned for that. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.